Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We obtained more than 150 pages of internal COP28 documents that reveal that the UAE, as host of the major UN climate summit, planned to use the event as an opportunity to lobby on oil and gas deals with foreign nations.
As the United Nations prepares to hold its largest climate summit ever in the United Arab Emirates, leaked documents show the UAE plans to use COP28, the summit, to make new oil and gas deals. We'll speak to the reporter who broke the story. Then we look at the crisis in Sudan as Human Rights Watch documents new mass ethnic killings in Darfur as fighting continues between rival military factions. And we'll remember former First Lady Rosalynn Carter, wife of President Jimmy Carter. A memorial service was held on Tuesday in Georgia.
And again, a special thank you, Secretary Clinton, Mrs. Bush, Mrs. Obama, Mrs. Trump, and Dr. Biden. Thank you all for coming and acknowledging this remarkable sisterhood that you share with my grandmother. And thank you all for your leadership that you provided for our country and the world. Secretary Clinton and Dr. Biden, we also welcome your lovely husbands.
We'll look at Rosalynn Carter's decades-long advocacy for mental health care. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Talks are ongoing to further extend the truce in Gaza as the temporary ceasefire enters its final day. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke at a NATO news conference in Brussels earlier today as he prepares to head back to Israel in the West Bank.
We'll be focused on doing what we can to extend the pause so that we can continue to get more hostages out and more humanitarian assistance in.
On Tuesday, 30 Palestinian women and children were freed from Israeli prisons after 10 Israelis and two foreign nationals were released from Gaza. This is Palestinian activist and student Ruba Assi, who was freed yesterday.
This joy is filled with pain and sacrifice, but also with a short victory. This feeling cannot be explained or put into words. We hope that all prisoners go through these moments and our heroic people will greet them. We hope this truce will be extended to a permanent ceasefire, and we wish freedom to our heroic people.
Israeli media says renowned Palestinian activist Ahed Tamimi, who was arrested earlier this month, could be released in an upcoming captive swap. Meanwhile, Palestinian prisoner associations say over the first 4 days of prisoner exchanges, Israel arrested 133 Palestinians, nearly as many as the 150 they released. Among the remaining hostages in Gaza is a 10-month-old baby and two American women. Some Gazans have returned to their abandoned homes as they grapple with the utter destruction left by the Israeli assault. A Palestinian mother said she was using rubble from her leveled home to make fire to cook over. Aid groups, including the World Food Program, are warning Gaza remains at risk of an even worse humanitarian crisis and that more assistance is urgently needed.
Our team saw hunger, desperation, and destruction. People who have not received any relief in weeks. Hundreds of thousands that are facing an immediate risk of starvation. WFP hopes for the extension of this pause, which offered a window of relief that could pave the way for longer-term calm. Safe and impeded humanitarian access cannot stop now.
An estimated 15,000 Palestinians have been killed in Israel's assault on the Gaza Strip. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces have surrounded three hospitals and are blocking medical teams as they conduct a major raid in the Jenin refugee camp. The head of Doctors Without Borders, Christos Christou, posted this video last night while trapped with staff at the Khalil Suleiman Hospital.
It's been already 2.5 hours that we are trapped in our hospital here in Jenin, while the Israeli forces are operating in another incursion in Jenin camp. There is no way for any of the injured patients to reach the hospital, and there's no way for us to reach these people.
Christa said at least two Palestinians died of their wounds while ambulances could not reach them during the siege. This comes amidst reports a 9-year-old Palestinian boy was shot by Israeli soldiers in Jenin this morning. The IDF has also destroyed at least two homes in Jenin, as well as roads and water mains, and rounded up at least 20 people. Rights groups say Israel's arrested 35 Palestinians throughout the occupied West Bank within the last 24 hours, including a 12-year-old child. Hisham Awartini, one of the three Palestinian college students shot in a likely hate crime in Burlington, Vermont, has released a statement from the hospital. Awartani, a Brown University student, said, quote, "It's important to realize that this is part of the larger story. I'm but one casualty in the much wider conflict. Had I been shot in the West Bank where I grew up, the medical services that saved my life would likely have been withheld by the Israeli army," he said. On Monday evening, Brown students interrupted a talk by the university president, Christine Paxson, at a vigil for the shot students, calling for the school to divest from weapons manufacturers, including Northrop Grumman, Raytheon, and Textron. At the Ramallah Friends School in the occupied West Bank, which was attended by all three shooting victims, students and staff reflected on the tragic attack. This is Leen Al-Shahab, a senior at Friends.
As Ramallah Friends School students, we're horrified by the recent attack that targeted three of our beloved Ramallah Friends School alumni and friends. As Ramallah Friends School students, we call upon international communities to conduct a full and thorough investigation on this attack, and we call upon for this attack to not be dismissed or ignored by any means. Today, as students, we're wearing the hatta as a symbol of, or the kafiyya as a symbol of, solidarity with our friends and for their families as well.
To see our interview with the head of the Ramallah Friends School, now General Secretary of the American Friends Service Committee here in the United States, Joyce Aljuni, go to democracynow.org. On Tuesday, Vermont Democratic Senator Peter Welch called for an indefinite extension to the ceasefire in Gaza. Welch's fellow senator from Vermont, Bernie Sanders, has yet to call for a permanent ceasefire. The Charles Koch Super PAC Americans for Prosperity Action has endorsed Nikki Haley for the 2024 Republican presidential nomination. Charles Koch and his network of right-wing billionaires is aiming to weaken frontrunner Donald Trump by throwing tens of millions of dollars and thousands of volunteers across the U.S. behind Haley's campaign. Among other things, the super PAC is known for blocking efforts to fight the climate crisis. The Texas Supreme Court heard arguments yesterday in the lawsuit challenging the state's near-total abortion ban. Patients have been refused care despite serious complications and forced to carry non-viable pregnancies to term, often at great personal risk. This is Molly Duane, a senior attorney at the Center for Reproductive Rights, which brought the case on behalf of 22 patients and doctors.
The last 2 years are an aberration from a centuries-long practice in Texas that allowed physicians broad discretion to provide abortion when necessary to preserve their patients' lives. The abortion bans as they exist today subject physicians like my clients to the most extreme penalties imaginable: life in prison and loss of their medical license. And while there is technically a medical exception to the bans, no one knows what it means, and the state won't tell us.
Panama's president said Tuesday a contested foreign-owned open-pit copper mine that's been at the center of recent nationwide protests would be shut down. The announcement came just hours after the Panamanian Supreme Court ruled a 20-year contract approved by Panama's government with the mine earlier this year unconstitutional. Protesters had said the new contract for the Cobre Panama mine, which is owned by Canada's First Quantum Minerals, was fast-tracked with little public input or transparency.
Mining is another expression of the rising corruption in the country. I think this sentence is a hard blow to corruption and a clear message to future governors of the country that we will not allow more impositions and corruption that restrict the sovereignty of the Panamanian people.
The copper mine is the largest in Central America. In a major victory for indigenous rights in Ecuador, an appeals court has sided with the Sicopai Nation to regain ownership of their ancestral homeland in the Amazon rainforest. The Sicopai people were forced out of their territory, called Pequeya, over 80 years ago during the Peru-Ecuador War in the 1940s. This ruling will mark the first time the Ecuadorian government grants a land title to an indigenous community whose ancestral land is now a protected area. The Sicopai are on the brink of extinction, with a population of only 800 in Ecuador and 1,200 in Peru. In a statement, Sicopai Nation President Elias Piowaje said, quote, "We are fighting for the preservation of our culture on this planet. Without this territory, we cannot exist as Sicopai people. Today is a great day for our nation. Until the end of time, this land will be ours," he said. In the Philippines, the government of President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. and the New People's Army, the military wing of the Communist Party of the Philippines, will revive peace talks for the first time in 6 years, facilitated by Norway. The negotiations were abruptly halted in 2017 by then-President Rodrigo Duterte. If successful, the NPA will end their half-century-long armed struggle and become a recognized political movement. This is Carlito Galvez, a former defense official, now presidential advisor.
Socioeconomic and environmental issues and the foreign security threats facing the country, the parties recognize the need to unite as a nation in order to urgently address these challenges and resolve the reasons of the armed conflict.
Last week, President Marcos Jr. issued an order granting amnesty to a number of rebel groups, including former members of the MPA and Communist Party. In Sierra Leone, 13 military officers and one civilian have been arrested after an alleged failed coup that left at least 20 people dead. Heavy gunfire broke out in the capital, Freetown, Sunday, as attackers targeted Sierra Leone's major military barracks near the presidential villa and two prisons where some 2,000 people were able to escape. Sierra Leone officials said the attacks were an attempt to overthrow the elected government. This is a resident of Freetown.
We are praying for this not to repeat, because this country belongs to all of us. If this continues, where are we supposed to go? Because we will not have this kind of peace in another man's country.
This comes just a few months after Sierra Leone's president, Julius Maada Bio, was reelected for a second term in a disputed June election. At least 8 other military coups have taken place in West and Central Africa since 2020, including Gabon and Niger this year. And in Atlanta, Georgia, President Biden and Jill Biden, Bill Clinton and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton joined other current and former leaders to pay tribute to Rosalynn Carter at her memorial service. All living first ladies were there. 99-year-old Jimmy Carter, who is now in home hospice care since last February, was also in attendance. Rosalynn Carter was active throughout her husband's political career, acting as advisor and strategist. She's also remembered as an advocate for mental health care and unpaid home caregivers. This is her son, James Earl Chip Carter III.
Mom was always well informed on the issues of the day. In the White House, Mom asked Dad so many questions that he finally said that she should attend cabinet meetings. So she did, and caught a lot of flack for that.
We'll have more on Rosalynn Carter and her mental health advocacy, both as an advocate and an inpatient, later in the broadcast. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
We begin today's show in Dubai, which is hosting the United Nations Climate Summit, known as COP28, Conference of Parties, that starts Thursday after a year that's likely to be the hottest ever recorded. This is expected to be the largest summit yet, with some 70,000 delegates and world leaders and senior officials from nearly every country coming to the United Arab Emirates. President Biden's attended the last two COP summits, and just this month, he called climate change the ultimate threat to humanity. But it has recently been announced he won't be attending this year. Pope Francis was set to be the first head of the Catholic Church to attend, but will instead join remotely due to health concerns. Doctors say he has the flu. Hundreds of Catholic institutions worldwide, but none in the United States, the world's top oil and gas producer, have announced plans to divest from oil, gas, and coal since the Pope called for a break with fossil fuels in 2015. The president of this year's climate summit is also head of the UAE oil giant Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, or ADNOC. Sultan Al Jaber is the first CEO to be a COP president.
We in the United Arab Emirates take this task of hosting COP28 with humility, with a deep sense of responsibility, and we also understand and fully appreciate how urgent this matter is. It has become a top priority for our leadership. I want everyone to know that we have the full political will to support a successful COP28.
But leaked briefing documents obtained by the Center for Climate Reporting reveal how the COP28 president and CEO plan to use his role in order to strike oil and gas deals with 15 countries. For China, the document showed ADNOC said it's, quote, willing to jointly evaluate international LNG, that's liquefied natural gas, opportunities in Mozambique, Canada, and Australia. Documents also outline plans to tell Colombia that ADNOC, quote, stands ready to help develop its oil and gas reserves. For more, we're joined by Ben Stockton, investigative reporter at the Center for Climate Reporting, where his new expose is headlined, COP28 President Secretly Use Climate Summit Role to Push Oil Trade with Foreign Government Officials, with a related piece, Inside the Campaign That Put an Oil Boss in Charge of a Climate Summit. Ben, this is great reporting. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, why don't you start off by talking about how the head of one of the largest oil companies in the world has become head of the UN Climate Summit, the largest one ever held. Democracy Now! Will be there all next week in UAE covering this climate summit. How did this all take place? And then talk about the leaked documents.
Sure. So I think what's really at the heart of this latest controversy goes back to the beginning of this year, which is when the UAE chose Sultan Al Jaber to be COP president. And like you say, he is not only the president of this year's UN Climate Summit, but he is also the CEO of the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company. He is a man who is actually very interesting. He's someone who wears many hats. Not only is he COP president and ADNOC CEO, he is also chairman of a UAE state-owned renewable energy company called Masdar. And he is also a UAE cabinet minister. So he really has many, many roles that he fulfills alongside his climate envoy role, which is why he is currently serving as COP28 president. And I think what really led to this position, and what we looked at in our piece with The Intercept was really how we got to the point where not only a CEO, but a CEO of a fossil fuel company became COP president. He is someone who over the past 15 years has really worked to push his international image and his green credentials. He is worked with major PR agencies to help shape that image, perhaps no more important than the American PR firm Edelman, who has worked with Al Jaber since the mid-2000s and continues to work today on COP28. So it has really been a long-term, meticulous, really, campaign that has led us to this point. And the point that we arrive at today is with these latest revelations that we worked on, we obtained more than 150 pages of internal COP28 documents. And they are briefings that are prepared for Al Jaber ahead of bilateral meetings with foreign governments. And I think the remarkable thing about these documents is that many of them include talking points that have been obtained from ADNOC and Masdar, the two companies that Al Jaber is involved in running. And we've obviously seen these revelations really spark a controversy, and many, many news outlets have picked up on this story. We worked on this initial story alongside reporters from the BBC, and we've seen this piece just really spread around the world.
And Ben, in terms of some of the most shocking aspects of these communications with some of the major countries in the world that are producing fossil fuels, could you talk about what most surprised you?
Yeah, I think that those examples that Amy picked out about China and about Venezuela were particularly interesting, and that's something we picked out in our reporting. A number of the documents mention the value of the sales and trading that ADNOC does with these countries. This can, you know, stretch into the hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions of dollars. And like Amy said, that There's mention of strategic partnerships, of potential opportunities for further international fossil fuel projects, as well as those Chinese and Venezuelan briefing documents. We also saw a document for a briefing for a meeting with the Brazilian government, and what that showed is that it appears that that Al Jaber planned to ask about a deal that was ongoing where ADNOC had actually made a bid for a Brazilian petrochemicals company called Braskem. So the specifics of these documents, I think, is what is really interesting. It does get into some kind of quite minute detail in terms of the business interests of ADNOC and Masdar in various countries around the world.
And can you talk about the involvement of advisors like Mohammed Al-Kabi and Oliver Phillips in COP28 and their ties to the National Oil Company?
Sure. So Al Jaber has quite a large team around him, and some of those people appear to be people who he has worked with across the course of his career. What we've been told previously by the COP28 team is that staff from staff for COP28 are independent. But actually, when we started asking about one particular individual, Mohammed Al-Kabi, as you mentioned, he is registered as the Director of Government Affairs for COP28. But some of the internal records that we'd seen seem to suggest that he had some ongoing role at ADNOC. Which we thought was very interesting, given those previous statements that the COP28 team had given us. So when we went back to them asking questions about Al-Kabi, they actually told us that he was somebody who worked across Al Jaber's entire portfolio, and like I said before, Al Jaber is someone who has many different roles, and seems to at least raise questions about the independence of the COP28 team from other entities in the UAE, particularly the oil company. Oliver Phillips is another man that we've written about before. He has played a key role in steering the PR efforts around COP28, and he also, at least previously, had a role at the Abu Dhabi National Oil Company. When we approached COP28 for comment on Phillips some time ago now for that Intercept piece, they told us that he was now working full time on the conference, but they didn't tell us when that employment with the oil company ended and when his employment with the COP28 team started. Our evidence, at least, would suggest that there was at least some crossover between his role at ADNOC and his role on the COP28 team.
Then just before we went to broadcast, we saw a press release that said Al-Jaber had stepped down as head of the COP, not head of the Abu Dhabi Oil Corporation. And then there was a news conference, actually. But it turns out this is all fake.
That's right. So I think there has actually been quite a bit of misinformation around this conference. It's something that some other outlets have written about quite extensively. There was an incident earlier this year where the UAE was accused of essentially using fake Twitter bots online to defend Sultan Al-Jaber and the COP28 and its role as host of COP28. I've also kind of looked a little bit at some of the movements online to boycott COP28, which seem to be associated with some fake Twitter profiles. So there really is quite a lot of misinformation around COP. And this latest press release that I've heard about going around this morning certainly seems to be part of that misinformation campaign.
And just to be clear, this fake news, this fake press release said he had stepped down as head of ADNOC, but would still head the COP. But again, this apparently is fake. I also wanted to turn to what you reported in September on the United Arab Emirates plans to counter and minimize criticism of the UAE's human rights abuses at COP28. This is a clip of leaked audio you obtained from an exploratory meeting between senior UAE officials and the country's COP28 team. We hear the COP's head of communications, Skonade Magichan.
We came up with, with the World Cup, and, we need to look at, they will use this opportunity
to bring in to the
absolutely. UAE, and at the end of the day, we're, hosting the COP28 and we're actually on behalf of the presidency, but we need to preserve the reputation of the UAE to look at how can we protect that and enhance the reputation and to try and minimize those attacks as much as possible.
Ben Stockton, can you talk about the significance of this?
I think it points to some of the accusations that the UAE is using COP28 as a chance to kind of boost its international reputation and improve, particularly its president Sultan Al-Jaber's, or the COP president Sultan Al-Jaber's international standing. Like you said, we obtained this recording between of a conversation between COP28 staff and senior UAE government officials, and what that recording showed was basically the UAE attempting to deflect or at least setting plans to deflect criticism of its human rights record, which we know the spotlight will be on during this conference. A number of the human rights groups have spoken out about political prisoners in the UAE and a record of human rights abuses in the country. And I think it really talks to this recording really talks to the issue of how the country might look to actually just not engage on those issues at all over the next couple of weeks, much to the annoyance of, I'm sure, of the human rights groups who will be watching.
And Ben, how do these revelations affect the credibility of the entire COP process? And what's been the response of experts and UN figures like Antonio Guterres?
Yeah, I think it's been a reaction of astonishment, really. We've heard from a number of senior people who have said that obviously these revelations do call into question the integrity of COP28. We've also heard from former Vice President Al Gore, who has been someone who has raised concerns about the conflicts of interest surrounding the COP presidency with Sultan Al-Jaber's role as both COP president and CEO of an oil company. And he described these revelations as really the realization of some of those conflict of interest concerns that had been raised, back in January when Al-Jaber was first announced as COP president.
Finally, Ben, are you going to be going? And are you concerned about reporters who are there? I mean, there are going to be 70,000 people there, but who step into these forbidden realms of questioning?
I'm not going to be attending. I'll be staying in New York during the course of COP28. Like you mentioned, there are various concerns about digital surveillance and kind of invasive practices, media freedom, particularly. From what I've seen so far at COP, it does seem that reporters are absolutely free to ask questions. There has been questions about our revelations earlier this week. But like I said, I'm planning to stay here in New York for